The Man in the Rubber Mask by Robert Llewellyn. Chapter 1. In the giant control room in the sky, there are banks and banks of lights on a huge, smooth, black control board, each one connected to an emotion or a significant experience of a human being on Earth. If only we were aware of them, our lives would be transformed. If only I knew that my irony warning light had been burning so regularly over the last 5 years, they kept having to replace the bulb. The irony light was full on, I now see, when I was carrying the last bag of props down 7 flights of stone steps in that Edinburgh apartment building. The warning light was on because I thought carrying 7 bags of props was hard work. I thought life was tough and the rest of the world was sitting around chatting and having tea, having sex or sleeping off the copious poisons of a night's debauchery. How come, I thought, I was heaving great big boxes of heavy stuff about so early on a Sunday morning? It was the beginning of September in 1988, the end of the Edinburgh International Festival of Theatre, Music, Dance, Poetry, Opera, Jazz, Film, Television and Shagging. I always had the feeling that there was a lot of the latter going on in Edinburgh, in between all of the former. This was the time of the year when Edinburgh turns into a thespian village. The thespian village was a concept that an old lovey who made an opening speech at the festival club along the lines of, "Once a year, the city of Edinburgh is turned into a giant thespian village," to which one embittered and no doubt hungover member of the audience mumbled, "Wanker," under his breath. Apart from shagging and thespians, there was an astonishing amount of drinking taking place. Astonishing for me, because I don't drink very much. 1/2 pint of watered-down lager, and I'm performing a sad comedy strippogram on a barroom table before you can say keep your dignity. If I drink a double whiskey, I'm transformed into a smiling human vomit cannon in about 30 seconds, so I stick to orange juice and very expensive mineral water. However, unlike most non-drinkers, I quite enjoy the company of drunk people. There are 2 bars open during the Edinburgh Festival where people I know lean against the wall and talk a lot. The Assembly Rooms and the Gilded Balloon. In the Assembly Rooms, we all stand around under huge posh chandeliers shouting and laughing in a loud, show-off sort of way. All the time we're talking to someone, we are looking round the room hoping to meet someone really famous. It's a complaint called Edinburgh Neck, an involuntary spinal twitch which ruins any conversation and reduces all communications to gag tryout and witty put-down. The room is packed full of insecure, loudmouth performers, agents and TV executives. I love it. The Gilded Balloon Bar is slightly different. It is where the exact same crowd go when they're pretending they hate the Assembly Rooms bar where they've just come from. I love doing that. I love going to the Gilded Balloon after I've been in the Assembly Rooms, twitching my head like a demented automaton, and then slagging everyone off for being so posy. Oh, I can't stand the Assembly Rooms. It's just utterly full of people looking round to see who's in. I mean, Lenny and Dawn walked in. That's Lenny, Henry and Dawn French, obviously. And everyone looked at them. I mean, it's pathetic. I said this to Arthur Smith, the man who played the barman in Backwards, and he said to me, "Oh, I met Lenny Henry once. Well, I didn't actually meet him. I saw him at a party." The Gilded Balloon Bar isn't quite as glamorous as the Assembly Rooms. It is in fact a narrow corridor leading to the toilet, but it will accommodate up to 170 very drunk comedians. Drunk comedians stand very close to you when they're in full flow. They tell you what you should do with your show, your life, or your lover. By 3 in the morning, it can begin to look rather sad, and if you're not deeply relaxed after 7 pints of designer lager, total cost £304.76, then the next best thing is to head home. The final bag was stuffed into my small, rusty hatchback car, and we set off. I breathed in the crisp Scottish air and brewery fumes for the last time, little knowing that by the time I got 12 miles down the road, one of the new, super-cheap remould tyres I had bought to get the car through its MOT would tear apart like a wet paper bag in a wind tunnel. My 2 companions, Martin Popple, who directed the play I'd written, and Deborah John Wilson, whose brother is Yaphet Kotto, the black guy in the original Alien movie, sat on the side of the road laughing as I struggled to get at the spare wheel from under the monstrous amount of stuff we were carrying. By some fluke, the spare wheel was pumped up. I found a jack and a spanner, so after a few more comedy wheel-changing moments, we were on our way. The reason I had super-cheap, fell-off-the-back-of-a-lorry, good-as-new tyres on the car was because I was skint, stony, brassic, cleaned out, poor as a church mouse, take your pick. This was my normal state of affairs. Nothing to worry about. I got by somehow. It was only odd because I'd just completed a sell-out run of a play I had written called Mammon, Robot Born of Woman. It had been nominated for the Perrier Award. and plays don't normally get nominated. Stand-up comics normally get nominated. So that meant it must have been good, even though it didn't actually win. Not that I cared, of course. I'm not competitive. I'm a thespian. I didn't care when Simon Fanshawe gave me a big hug in the bar of the Assembly Rooms and told me with barely concealed delight that I hadn't won. "Robbie, darling," he shouted, "you haven't won. Isn't it absolutely dreadful?" Simon is a lovely, loud, gay comedian. He was a very big figure in the 1980s and wore even bigger glasses. Okay, if I'm really, really honest, it would have been quite nice to win. But as soon as the play was nominated, it was packed to the roof. Even the bloke who runs the Assembly Rooms, Bill Coutts, couldn't get in. He had to bring his own chair and sit behind the stage to watch. The play, Mammon, Robot Born of Woman, was about a robot, as you can probably tell from the title. Not at all like Crichton, Mammon was supposed to be a robot who resembled a human to such a degree no one other than his maker could tell. It was sort of the Frankenstein story, mixed in with a bit of Robocop, bit of Terminator, and a few silly walks. The twist was that instead of the maker being a mad male scientist, she was a mad female scientist. Dawn Raid, played by Deborah John Wilson, was black and had made the perfect white man in order to enter the marketplace or the stock exchange and start making money. Remember, this was 1988, before Black Wednesday, Black Friday, and that rather dull grey Tuesday morning in early April. At this time, there were still wide boys in the City of London pulling down 800k a year gross and thinking they were terribly clever. I was brought up to believe it was bad manners to laugh at other people's misfortune. But the day after Black Wednesday, I cycled through the City of London laughing my head off and pointing at sad, dejected-looking businessmen in their crumpled pinstripes. It was an amazing sight to see so many deeply unhappy, seriously rich people. In the story, Mammon made money on the stock market very successfully, but as he progressed, Dawn noticed he started to develop certain human characteristics. He was designed to blend in with his environment, which is what he did. He started to become like the men he worked with. Dawn, being a slightly mad scientist, takes the next step. She introduces Lust Mode 691, the ultimate in sexuality software, into Mammon's computer brain. At this point, Mammon copulated with everything on stage, including some members of the audience, unlucky enough to be seated in the front row. It was a disgusting spectacle, and it should have been banned. I remember thinking during those rare moments of speculative thought actors have during performing, that it was an odd thing for a grown man to be doing. Pretend to copulate with a desk in front of 200 people in a small room in Edinburgh. Little did I know the irony warning light was flicking on the big control panel in the sky. I'd seen nothing yet. With a new super cheap remould tyre fitted to the super cheap car, we continued our journey south. I dropped Deborah off in Manchester, where she was staying with some friends, for a while to recover from the Edinburgh trauma. Next stop, Leicester, where I dropped off Martin, the man who directed Mammon, at his parents'. We had a cup of tea, and I asked him if the playwright of the family, Joe Orson, who came from Leicester, used to live near them. He didn't. I drove the last leg of the journey alone, arriving in London in the early hours of the morning, dumped all the props and bags in the hall, listened to the three messages on my answer machine from my mum, and collapsed into bed. One of the first things I did the following day was go through the press list to see who had come to see the play. During the hectic schedule of doing the show every day, getting in and out of the theatre in such a short time meant that I only took the barest note of what people had said to me. All sorts of heavyweight, as in influential, not overweight, as in tubby, media people came to see the show, and as I scanned the list, I saw a name that I knew, Paul Jackson. I knew he did The Young Ones and loads of other things. He was one of those people who did a lot of stuff on telly. Other than that, I thought nothing of his attendance. The play had been commissioned as a six-part sitcom by Channel 4. Mammon was going to be on the small screen. That was what was really exciting. I had discovered this over lunch one day back in Edinburgh. Seamus Cassidy, then the head honcho for Mirthmakers at Channel 4, had seen the show and liked it. I'd worked with Seamus on a not-so-glowingly successful sitcom I co-wrote for Channel 4 in 1986 called The Corner House. This particular sitcom was made up of a great deal of sit and very little com. Ah, well, we all have to fail sometime, but why so publicly? If an accountant fails, only he and one or two other people know about it. If a writer/actor fails, everyone you know will have seen what you do and will agree loudly that you have failed. They will smile and say, "You know, your sitcom, The Corner House, it was on the telly last night, Bob." And I nod proudly, waiting for the praise. "Yeah, you failed. You failed, Bob," they say sadly. "You really, really failed. Therefore, Mammon's success was of great importance to me. I don't want to go back too far. But when my mum used to change my nappy... No, that is too far. Just a couple of years back, before all this, I was in a four-man comedy, satire, slapstick and music group called The Joeys. I did that from 1980 until 1985, and it was very successful, considering we hardly ever appeared on telly. Anyway, that's another story. All I'm saying is that between 1985 and 1988, I'd been busy. But busy in a sort of cold, miserable failure type of way, rather than a warm, glowing success type of way. So Seamus Cassidy had commissioned me to convert Mammon into a six-episode situation comedy. It was great. I worked day and night on the scripts and storylines, developing the characters, introducing new ones, throwing the whole thing away and starting again. It was actually 2 years later that I discovered Channel 4 could never have afforded to make the series, but by then everything had changed beyond recognition. Mammon never made it to the small screen, not in the original way I'd intended anyway. But on July the 10th, 1989, about 9 months later, the gestation period for babies and weird events, I locked my pushbike to a lamppost on the Charing Cross Road. I was going to have a meeting with Paul Jackson and some other blokes about some sort of part in some sort of sitcom. That's all I knew. I entered the little door at the old Noel Gay office and was met by Paul Jackson's braces and tie. As the glowing sensations settled in my eyeballs, I shook hands with the figure behind. Paul immediately showed me downstairs. I entered a basement office to see three men sat around a table, a tall, gangly, skinny one called Ed, and two slightly shorter, stockier ones called Rob and Doug. We talked about robots and funny walks and accents and trying to avoid all the old comedy robots, R2-D2, Marvin the Paranoid Android, and how to find another way of doing it. Looking back, it was the first time I experienced the Grant Naylor gaze. These four eyes which record every tiny nuance of your behaviour and start to reprogram it in their weird heads so 2 years later you find yourself in costume doing something oddly familiar. After this meeting I realised what they were talking about. I had seen about 3 episodes of the first 2 series of Red Dwarf, but as I worked at night as a stand-up comic and actor, I missed a lot of telly. I knew Norman Lovett from the comedy circuit, and I knew he was in the series. We had worked together on various things over the years. In fact, my first ever experience of working in television was with Norman. It was on a Channel 4 show called, wait for it, this is what it was called, I promise you, Book 'em and Risk It. It had the exclamation mark at the end of it like that, Book 'em and Risk It! Brilliant. This programme presented the talents of people like Norman, Ben Elton and the Joeys, the group I was in. The idea behind the programme was that because we were aspiring young performers, we would do anything to get on a telly show. We were supposed to be storming the entrance lobby of a TV company and doing the show right here. The director, Mr. Brian Izzard, no relation of Eddie, would not contradict me, I think, if I said he was not Britain's leading non-sexist man. A charming and hard-working individual who'd been in the business many years, Brian dealt with me very kindly when I tried to point out to him that the Joeys were trying to create a new form of non-sexist, non-racist humour, and we really didn't like his references to secretaries with big tits, etc. He put his arm round me and stared into the middle distance. With a tight smile he said, "I still love you, Robert, but you do your job and I'll do mine. Off you go. Still love you, darling." With that, he gently pushed me away and got on with his job. As the rehearsals continued, Norman, who I'd only just met, seemed to get even more depressed. He really wasn't happy about something, presumably being called a child by the director. Mr. Izzard had a habit of saying, "Come along now, children," to the cast, whose ages range from 19 to 50. As we were doing some sort of blocking and confusing rehearsal, Norman said something like, "Sod this for a lark," and walked out, never to be seen again. He didn't miss much. The show went out early in Channel 4's history and thankfully sank without trace. I saw Norman regularly over the next few years. One very memorable time was when I was compere at a comedy club in Woolwich, South London, called The Tramshed. Just before I went on stage to announce him, Norman asked me to time him from when he went on stage to when he first spoke. I nodded, not really understanding what he was asking. I went onto the stage and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together in a warm and supportive manner for the very wonderful Mr. Norman Lovett." The crowd went bananas and Norman sloped onto the stage looking slightly moth-eaten and miserable. He stood behind the microphone. The clapping died down. The room became quieter as the audience waited for the first gag. Norman stood there in silence. Someone laughed. Norman looked at them. The whole audience laughed. He looked at the whole audience. They laughed again. Norman hadn't uttered a sound. I was looking at my watch at the side of the stage. 2 minutes. The other comics on that night crowded around at the back of the room. They knew Norman was going for his record. He stood motionless, picked out by the single spotlight. The audience went silent again, not a sound. Norman stared at them. It was a comic's nightmare, standing there in utter silence. Then someone snickered. Norman gave the person the most cursory of glances, and immediately the whole audience started laughing again. 4 minutes. He'd been standing on the stage in front of 300 people for 4 minutes, entertaining them, somehow, by doing absolutely nothing. It was very funny. It was utterly infectious. Even the hardened old pros at the side of the stage were roaring with laughter. There must have been 10 periods of nerve-wracking silence, each one broken by someone bursting out laughing, looking at this gaunt, miserable bloke standing on the stage wearing a cardigan. At 7 minutes 20 seconds, after a huge prolonged wave of laughter, Norman said, "What?" and got an ovation. I'd seen Norman's face on a screen on the wall of some sleeping quarters in a sitcom set in space with Craig Charles, who I'd seen in the bar of the assembly rooms in Edinburgh. I'd rubbernecked as I was talking to someone else. I thought, there's that bloke, the one who's married to that woman who was in Mona Lisa with Bob Thingamy. Then I looked at the woman sitting next to him. It was that woman from Mona Lisa with Bob Thingamy. There was another man with an H on his forehead. I recognised him too. It was Chris Barry. I'd seen him at the Comedy Store years before, doing amazing impressions.
Oh, extraordinary, David Coleman.
Then another man came in. He had amazing clothes on and big teeth. He was called Cat. I didn't know him. I'd never seen him anywhere. That's because I hadn't been to see 300 West End musicals Danny John Jules had already found divadom in. About 3 weeks after I went to meet Rob, Doug, Ed and Paul Jackson, I drove to the BBC Special Effects Department in Acton. I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. I was, like most of the world's population, a prosthetic virgin. If only I'd been aware of the irony warning lights flashing in the heavens when I'd spoken to Rob and Doug. I had explained to them that I was slightly concerned about playing a robot or a mechanoid, because I was midway through developing a series for Channel 4 about a robot, and I didn't want to get typecast. Rob and Doug assured me that it wouldn't be a problem. They thought that very few people would recognise me. I think it's important to remember that I was very reassured by this. When I say important, I mean to keep the concept of this importance in context. It wasn't very important in the grand scheme of things, like it wouldn't be very important to someone in northern Thailand or in the Horn of Africa. It was only important to me for about a minute, which isn't very high in a world ranking of important things. I entered the special effects room and was greeted by Peter Ragg, the master, the genius, the man behind Thunderbirds, Doctor Who and who knows what else, the quiet, retiring head honcho of BBC Special Effects. "Oh, this shouldn't take too long, Robert," he said. "We're just going to cover your head with dental alginate and about £15 of plaster bandage. Do you want a cup of tea?" He led me through rooms where men in white overalls were making exploding chairs for Noel Edmonds' Big Big Breakfast Show. This was the room they made the Daleks in. The Cybermen's Wellingtons were sprayed silver in this very building. Everywhere I looked, there were old rubber monsters, slathering beasts with eyes on stalks. There were severed heads and rubber arms, model spaceships and boats, men sitting at benches sawing small bits of metal. We entered a room white with plaster dust, where I met Beth Ann Jones, who was head of the Red Dwarf makeup department. She was Welsh, and as soon as I walked into the room, she said, "I knew you weren't really Welsh. I thought you'd be fake Welsh." I took great umbrage at this. Fake Welsh, with a name like Llewellyn? How could she? Of course, the truth is that I'm about as Welsh as a croissant. But somewhere in my past there must have been a couple of taffs. Peter and Beth Ann Jones discussed my head. Peter pointed at the bridge of my nose with a pen.
If we can carve in here quite steeply, he said, we'll get a better shape in the forehead.
What were they going to do? Put my head in a vice and get out a chisel? I wanted to look at the small print in my contract. I could see it clearly in my mind's eye. Why hadn't I taken a closer look at this? Section 4A, subsection F9, clause 18. The artist shall render his head, face and all areas above the throat to the company for modification, enhancement and radical change. All surgery costs and corrective therapy needed after the production to be paid for by the artist. I didn't remember reading that bit. As I sat in the chair, which was placed in the middle of the room, I was assured by Peter Ragg that I wasn't about to have radical surgery.
Some people, said Beth Ann Jones as she stuck a rubber bald cap over my hair, go completely mad when their heads are covered in plaster of Paris. Do you think you'll be all right, Robert? Llewellyn? I didn't know how to answer. It was a bit like being told some people die when they have a steamroller drive over them. Do you think you'll survive? Having never had my head covered in plaster of Paris bandage before, it was difficult to judge. I don't think I was claustrophobic. I'm a pretty well-balanced sort of guy, most of the time. As my body was wrapped in black bin bags, I began to get the distinct impression I wasn't going to have a lot of choice in the matter. I was going to get covered whether I went mad or not. Here's a pad of paper and a pen, said Peter, handing me the same. This is in case you need something scratching when you're under. Just write down which bit is itching, and we'll try and scratch it. Then put a tick if we get it right. You see, you won't be able to speak, hear, see, or smell anything while you're under. I gripped the pen and paper as if they were my last hope. We start with a mouth and nose, said Peter, who was now mixing a large plastic bowl full of bright yellow stuff which looked a little bit like putty. This is alginate, the stuff I make dental moulds out of. It's quite minty in taste, but it is a bit cold when we first put it on. I nodded in the special way I've developed when I don't understand anything but want to appear that I do. We cover your nose and mouth first, then you blow through your nose and we make a little hole for you to breathe through. We need it to actually go in your mouth, so you can keep your mouth open very slightly, all right? As I nodded yes, Peter slapped a great big handful of this minty gloop right in my face. It was very cold. It covered my nose, went into my mouth, forced my lips apart, ran over my teeth, settled around my tongue and went sort of rubbery hard. It was like eating minty custard that went solid as you ate it. It was like being covered in semi-solid toothpaste. It was like nothing else I had ever experienced. They covered my eyes next, then my neck, ears, the top of my head. Their voices became muffled. All the sound was distorted as I felt something heavy and wet being slopped on top of the minty, rubbery goo. I assumed this would be the plaster of Paris bandage. I felt a lot of rubbing and scribbling about. My head started to get heavier. All I could hear was my breathing, all of which was taking place through one nostril, which naturally, after a few minutes, started to itch. And I mean itch. Like the itch at the centre of the universe. What can I do? It must only have been seconds, but it seemed like ages. My whole consciousness was focused on this itchy nostril. I tried to wipe it from my brain. I tried to think about sex, car crashes, mountain streams in the dappled sunlight, wide open seascapes, the mountains outside Vancouver, anything except this damn nostril. Then I remembered the pen and paper I was holding in my sweaty little hands. I wrote as best I could, seeing as the whole thing was done by touch, N-O-S-T-R-I-L-I-T-C-H. I heard muffled noises and movements around me. I couldn't tell what was going on until suddenly I felt something poke up my nostril. I found out later it was one of those blue makeup removal things with cotton wool spun on each end. It did the trick. The relief was monumental. In the normal course of events, an itchy nostril is hardly something you comment on. You don't call a halt to a conversation and say, "Hold it, wait, I've got an itchy nostril, everyone stay calm." You just rub it, pick it, flick it, and be done with it. Not so when your head is encased in 7 pounds of plaster of Paris. My steady, regular breathing continued. In, out, in, out. I became super aware that I was an animal, that I had lungs which were two big bags which had to fill with air, and then blow it out again. Then I could hear my pulse. Thrub, thrub. I could almost see my heart, this funny, pumpy thing which keeps going day and night until I pop my clogs. How does it know? Why doesn't it just forget to beat? Why don't I just snuff it? I felt my heart rate increase. Thrubb, thrubb, thrubb. I felt a small rush of adrenaline. Maybe I would die with this bloody thing on my head. Maybe they wouldn't be able to get it off, and I would starve to death slowly. I'd never see anyone again. My girlfriend, my mates, my mum and dad. It was all over. I could see the headlines. Princess Di has ladder in tight shock. Let's face it, who would write about some sad actor who starved to death inside a plaster of Paris head mould in the BBC's special effects department in Acton? I tried to control these maddening daydreams. I tried to think about sex, great big heaving, pulsating, sweating. No, it didn't work. It was a big shock. Never before in my life had I been unable to have a kinky sexual fantasy. I'd had them during school exams. I'd had them when I was failing my driving test. I'd had them when I was having sex. But now, not a sausage. In fact, a sausage would have been about the kinkiest thing I could have thought about. What a breakthrough, though, for sex offenders. They get sentenced to 10 hours a day with their heads cased in plaster of Paris. It just stops all that stuff. Well, it did for me. Maybe it wouldn't work for everyone. I don't believe there are edges to human sexuality. I bet there's some bloke somewhere who is rock hard for Plaster of Paris. I bet there's a magazine you can buy in an Amsterdam bookshop called Kinky Plaster of Paris Monthly. Well, it's not so daft. I've seen a magazine called Enema Digest. I don't want to go on about Plaster of Paris forever, but there were the Chicago Plastercasters, weren't there? This was a team of young women artists in the late 1960s who went around making plaster casts of famous rock stars' erect penises. Firstly, they encouraged the erection, in whichever manner was most appropriate, and then they covered the appendage with plaster of Paris. Once it had set, they removed the mould and filled it with wax and a bit of string and made candles out of them. Oh, all right, I admit it, I tried it. I saw this documentary about mad American sex therapists, which had a section about these women. I was young. I was impressionable. I went home and tried it, all right? I had a bit of plaster of Paris left over from building hills for my model railway set. I was halfway through the process, I don't want to go into details, but it did seem to be working, when suddenly my mother called to me from downstairs that it was tea time. I quickly tried to remove 2.5 pounds of semi-hard plaster from my semi-hard manhood. I had forgotten one vital element. The Chicago plaster casters used a plastic sheet with a hole in it to avoid the plaster of Paris getting caught on the model's pubic hair. Okay, it's all gone a bit gross, I know, but anyway, I hadn't thought about that particular aspect of this operation. There is no real way of describing the pain that comes from hanging 2.5 pounds of plaster of Paris from 3 or 4 pubic hairs, but let's agree that it is intense. I was panicking. I knew my mum was going to walk into my bedroom and I was going to suffer some fairly hefty adolescent humiliation. Luckily, I had a pair of nail scissors on my bedside table, and with a bit of judicious snipping, I managed to remove the offending rock. I did eventually make a wax mould of my downstairs department. It looked like, well, you know when you clean out the vegetable rack and you find a 6-month-old carrot that has dried up and shrivelled? It was sad, and it took me many years to get over. I was still under the plaster mould at the BBC Special Effects Department in Acton. This state of affairs seemed to go on for hours. My ears were straining for any sound. I couldn't hear anyone. I imagined Peter Ragg and Beth Ann Jones and the lads had all gone out into the sunshine. They were sitting on the steps, smoking and drinking tea, reading the papers and chatting about football. I imagined Peter Ragg saying, "We could all go down the pub if you like. We've got to wait a couple of hours for it to go off. Not much we can do, really." Suddenly, there was a cracking sound, a deafening, creaking, wrenching noise, as if the very bowels of the earth were being ripped asunder. I felt my head move, not much, just a judder, and then the pressure on my face was suddenly gone. After a little more creaking, there was a huge relief on my neck. The enormous weight of the back half of the mould was lifted away, and I could suddenly hear. "Tip your head forward, Robert," said Peter Ragg. "We'll ease the mask off slowly, then wriggle your face a bit." I did as I was told, and slowly the mask moved. I could see light again. The minty lump was dragged from my mouth, and I emerged back into the real world. "That wasn't too bad, was it?" said Beth Ann Jones with her jaunty Welsh accent. "Not too bad in comparison to being strapped to the underside of a battle tank on manoeuvres through a bramble patch at top speed. No." That's what I thought. What I said, of course, was, "No, it was fine." I said that because I'm a well-brought-up person, or as Craig would say, a softy middle-class bastard. They peeled the ball patch off and I had a wash, rubbing life back into my face. I returned to the casting room to see the plaster cast of my head emerging from the mould. It looked like the head of some sort of plug-ugly alien with bad posture. My neck had collapsed under the weight. My head was shunted forward so far I looked like a hungry giraffe. I couldn't believe it was me. I had a sideways nose, a double chin, and a bumpy head. There was another warning light on the control panel in the sky. The small print beneath read, "It's not over yet." Next, I had to stand in between two supports on which I rested my arms and have a body cast. This is where the whole torso and upper arm area of the victim is wrapped in plastic cling film, then covered in plaster bandage up to a weight of several tons. It is not an intellectually stressful task. You have to stand up, stay still, and shut up. I was moaning and complaining as the plaster overcoat got heavier and heavier and my feet started hurting. If you've never stood absolutely still for a long time, it's difficult to imagine how something so simple could be so bloody uncomfortable. When you wait for a bus or stand looking at a painting, as I'm sure many of you do, you are actually flitting about like a bird.
constantly shifting your weight from one foot to the other, scratching your bum and tapping your feet about. When you have to stand still, not move a muscle, it takes about 40 seconds before you become uncomfortable. 3 minutes to be internally whinging, and after 20 minutes you can bore anyone to death with your list of complaints. I'd learned this many years before when a friend taught me into posing in her life drawing class. I had to stand in funny positions without a stitch on so that a lot of quite normal looking people could draw my bits. Well, okay, they usually drew the rest of me first, but I was convinced they were really interested in my bits. After only a few moments, what had started out as a very comfortable pose would become agony, and it was always made worse when the teacher said, "Only another 35 minutes." They liked drawing me because I was so thin in those days. It was almost like drawing a human skeleton. Their other favourite model at the time was the opposite, Mr. Lard Mountain, they called him. I never met him, but I saw the drawings. He was big. I mean fat big, but also big big. He was big everywhere. All their drawings corroborated this. It made me very depressed. I was 21, and that sort of thing is of prime importance then. Normally it was quite warm in the life drawing class, although sometimes in the winter it would get a bit chilly, and the old single Polaroid tended to turn into a passport photo. Except one time. Oh, I shouldn't tell you. Ah, but what the hell. Okay, I was modelling, that's what they call it, at the Royal Academy in London. Dead posh, proper art students, really old building, proper teachers. I even got to lie on a bed. They had this amazing bed with things like car jacks under each corner that could lift and tilt the bed into any position. All I had to do was lie on it, and they wiggled me around into the position they wanted. It was so warm and comfy, I was very happy. I was being paid to lie still on a comfy bed. I started to nod off. I felt sensual and warm, happy and fulfilled. The room around me disappeared and I entered a gentle, loving place. After a while, I started to sort of wake up because I sensed something had changed. There was a different emphasis going on in my lower groinal area. I opened one eye and glanced down in the downstairs direction. It was, of course, the worst possible thing that could happen. A double Polaroid right in front of 30 art students. Some of them girls. In fact, most of them girls. I thought about dustbins. I knew that's what you were supposed to do in such situations. The trouble was, dustbins made me think of having filthy, kinky sex in a dustbin. That was no good. I tried car engines, oily sex under a car engine, football, muddy sex on a football field. It was hopeless. I was desperate to try and flick a bit of cloth over it, but it was no good. Eventually, when the teacher called a break in the class, I rolled off the bed and pulled my trousers on pretty damn quick. No one uttered a word about it. I took a cursory glance at some of the students' work. They hadn't drawn it. There was a bit of rubbing out where they'd moved it a bit on the page, but they'd stayed well within the bounds of flaccidity. I found out later that it was a daily occurrence, and that no one had even noticed. Then I got depressed. Because no one had noticed. There's no pleasing some people, is there? Years later, back in the BBC special effects department in Acton, Peter Ragg calmly kept applying Plaster of Paris bandage, smoothing it in and building up odd little ridges which would help when it had set and he'd removed it. The relief when this great lump of stuff came off was immense. I felt light as a feather, but was again depressed at the sight of this pot-bellied hunchback torso that, in my mind, was a lightweight version of Arnold Schwarzenegger. After having my hands moulded, which was the least difficult, and being measured to bits, I was allowed to go. Surprisingly enough, looking back, I still really had no idea what I was letting myself in for.